I think we are ready to bring on my next guest, who is actually my first guest of the day. And I'm really happy that he had the chance to join us a little early. So let me bring him on. Dr. Ian McDonald is a BBC-trained radio producer who started The Vegan Option because he wanted to do baitivism for the brain. Really interesting radio that just happened to be vegan. He's taking sabbatical from paid employment to record interviews with world-leading experts, pore over esoteric research in the British Library, and travel to the places where the story unfolded, including the length and breadth of India, to bring the story to listeners. The UK's leading art radio station, Resonance FM, broadcasts vegetarianism, the story so far, on the first Tuesday of each month. This 15-part story is approaching its conclusion to be broadcast on June 6, 2017. You can discover The Vegan Option, including vegetarianism, the story so far, at theveganoption.org. And Ian McDonald, welcome.
Thank you for that incredible introduction, Karen.
Thank you. Well, you sound pretty incredible, and I'm really, really honored to have you join me today. Thank you, and thanks for coming on a little early.
My pleasure.
But I think we have plenty to talk about.
Oh, goodness. Thousands of years of history. I remember one of my guests, Renan Leroux, who wrote the French language history of vegetarianism, called it 25 centuries of debate. And the challenge of this series has always been what to leave out from
That's fascinating. Mm-hmm.
From the orgiastic vegetarian heretical cult of 1790s Massachusetts to the Manichaeans, the lost world religion, the Ajivikas, the rivals to Buddhism that have gone by the wayside and seemed, from what we know, to be very pro-vegetarian themselves. It really is an incredible and mostly unknown story. Even the fact that people are beginning to relearn that Pythagoras is known to celebrate Pythagoras not so much for the square of the hypotenuse and the sum of the square of the opposite two sides as for his contribution towards vegetarianism. But there's a whole there is a whole wealth of background to the story of people trying to spare animals from the dinner table.
Well, this is very exciting, and I know that throughout history, we're talking about history, but for example, many of the minority groups or the groups that aren't in power, their history tends to get lost in general. And to empower those people, hearing their history is one important piece. So it's important for vegetarians and vegans to hear our history and empower us to know how long this has been going on and connect with all of those who came before us.
Yes, that's really important. And although sometimes, vegetarianism has the upper hand. I mean, the oldest surviving document to mention vegetarianism was an edict of Ashoka in Kandahar in present day Afghanistan. Ashoka was an emperor of India in about the 3rd century BCE, and his empire stretched from modern-day Bangladesh to modern-day Afghanistan. But fascinatingly, if you talk to somebody about a Greek Buddhist kingdom, it sounds like something from an alternative universe, but it actually happened where the Greek worlds where the Greek worlds and the Indian worlds overlapped at the furthest reaches of Alexander the Great's conquests in present-day Pakistan and Afghanistan. And so there was an edict in Aramaic and Greek in Kandahar saying, amongst other things, that the King Ashoka, this this great emperor who as the way he told his story, turned away from violence at the end of his bloodiest battlefield, said that and boasted of how few animals his kitchen slew, because of the difference, because of the way things are phrased in different languages. It's the one in Kandahar that actually says the king abstains from animate beings, that actually uses the clear Greek idiom for vegetarianism. It just happens to be in Greek because it's a Greek Buddhist kingdom. All the rest of them are in local language. They're usually in the king's language, the Prakrit that the king would have spoken. But this one is in Greek, and so we know it says vegetarian. But sadly, and obviously that's not a subaltern culture. That's actually something that was put in place by the most powerful man on earth. But because he had the power to write it down, it survived until, of course, the boot was on the other foot and it disappeared from the Kabul Museum during the Afghan Civil War, which actually, to think that that stone lasted for 2,000 years. It was discovered in 1960s, and once modern humanity actually dug it up again, it lasted barely a lifetime. but certainly you get the subaltern, the less powerful people story as well. Often vegetarianism is the voice of the political radicals. One of the first people to condemn slavery in English is the merchant and diet guru of the late 17th century, Thomas Tryon, who actually had houses not far from where I'm talking to you from in East London. And in many ways, he was the first vegetarian diet guru. He tried to take some of the Greek works that were being printed and make some of these intellectual works more accessible in terms of practical farming and medical advice for people. But he also promulgated vegetarianism. He was also against slavery, and this kind of progressive ideology has long been part of the vegetarian movement. One of the things that brought vegetarians together at the end of the 18th century in Britain, again, not a little biased towards the places I can get to, possibly a little biased towards the places I could get to in a 15-minute walk, is because the vegetarians sided. What's happening in the 1790s, the French Revolution. America has just had a democratic revolution, and the French one is far bloodier. But the radicals are on the side. They're infused by the spirit of Thomas Paine. There's actually one of the vegetarian. There's actually a particularly radical vegetarian of the French Revolution that Thomas Paine turned to, and who was particularly bloodthirsty when it came to repressing the people who weren't revolutionary enough. And Thomas Paine turned to him and said, "I fear that you have had so little meat that your thirst for blood can only be slaked by human blood now." But what the British government always does with radicals, it seems, is to put them in prison together. And then they always form a movement. And so this happened in London, where a lot of the radicals were sympathetic to the French Revolution. They were under suspicion. They were in favour of these terrible things like democracy. So they slammed them in Newgate. They were in and out of Newgate prison. And the same people, and broadly the same crowd, were publishing a vindication of the publishing a vindication of the rights of women by Mary Wollstonecraft and The Cry of Nature by Joseph Ritson, which is a early radical appeal for vegetarianism and to spare animal suffering. In fact, Joseph Ritson became kind of the nasty militant vegetarian that other people would compare themselves to go and say, yes, we're vegetarian, but we're not ranty like Joseph Ritson. So often there's this radical progressive element. You can see that in the English Civil War. You can see that in the French Revolution. You can see that in American politics with many of the abolitionists. Yes. There's the settlement in Kansas, the Octagon Settlement, where the Vegetarian Society really throws itself into trying to settle Kansas and make it a free state rather than a slave state, has its own settlement. There are people who there are people from that vegetarian settlement in Kansas that take up arms, that go around trying to kill as many slavers as possible. There are others who are pacifist and conflicted. Henry Clubb, who's originally British, but he comes to America he helps with the vegetarian movement. He takes over the Vegetarian Bible Christian Church. But his answer to the American Civil War, to the cry to abolish slavery, is to say, I will not carry a gun, but I will enlist. And he's a quartermaster, and he actually takes a bullet for the United States. And so the story goes, it's stopped by his naturalization papers.
Mm.
It just happens to hit. It happens to hit the wallet. So they're
fascinating.
Our predecessor is definitely part of that strand.
Yeah. So it sounds like you've got thousands and thousands of stories. You know, you mentioned when you were talking about the Greek and what was Pakistan, I think, did you say before?
Pakistan, Afghanistan.
So one of the difficulties is language. We certainly see it with religion, where the religion changes as the interpretation of the documents are translated. People can translate things in the way they understand them or the way they want to see them. And very often language cannot be exactly translated from one to another to get the meaning. And I imagine that it's the same with vegetarianism. I remember Rin Barry telling another vegetarian historian who would tell the story about the word for fish that could have also have meant plant meats, mushroom, and other things in terms of whether Jesus ate a vegetarian diet or other things. It's fascinating.
It's fascinating, but when I raised that example with a scholar of the New Testament, who I was mainly talking to about these fascinating early Christian vegetarian groups, he said that, one, that's not the obvious, in the context of the obvious interpretation is fish, even though, yes, Rimberry was right that that's an alternative interpretation, but also, more importantly, the Gospel of John uses a different word, which is not so ambiguous. So it's kind of hard to support a entirely vegetarian interpretation of the loaves and fishes story. Although, of course, the implication is that he was magicking them out of nowhere, which is ethically different from killing them.
Mm.
And of course, we're dealing with a tradition of Jesus that we can know that is itself, you know, quite recent after what would have been his lifetime, but it's still it's still a swiftly emerging tradition that obviously owes things to other ideas that are in the space.
So how do you do your research and put things together? Do you speak a lot of languages?
I don't. There's a lot of relying on other people. So I know in some a lot of places I'll try and look at two different translations. I'll try and look at the crucial words. So in some cases, there was an example of a reading from Indian scriptures, which I wanted to take a look at, and I wondered how to interpret it. And I actually was able have a quick email exchange with an academic who was in the midst of translating another section of the text. So you do get people who very, very graciously, these are people who are expert historians in that particular area, and I just have some to be intersecting their interests. In terms of the interviews, it'll be a question of finding out the broad area and then discovering who actually is researching it. So I looked up who'd written papers about the Ebionites, who are an early Christian/Jewish group. Interestingly, these, before Christianity and Judaism had entirely diverged, they seem to, and particularly in present-day Syria and Iraq, there seem to be a lot more groups of vegetarian Christians.
Mm.
And so I was mainly interviewing that particular guest about that, but I had the chance to ask him, well, what's about the translation of the loaves and fishes story? But yes, it really is a live issue. Often, in the case of ancient Greek work, I compare translations, but I also looked at the Greek to make sure that I was translating the idiom for abstains from animate beings in the same way in all the texts. So it was consistent, and so people could follow the fact that it was this idiom, this way of saying vegetarian. And it is so fascinating as a subject. There's an early translation of the Laws of Manu, where an early Victorian translator in the late 19th century really impressed me by managing to translate a pun from, it would have been Sanskrit, so that it still worked in English, which was
amazing.
So you have to be in awe of these people. But sometimes I found out, I mean, sometimes I have a reference that, I think in the case of the early Sikh gurus, I thought I had a reference. Sorry, it was one of the, it was a precursor to one of the Sikh gurus. It was one of the gurus that kind of stood between Islam and Hinduism in the Punjab in the 16th century. But there was a line of his that suggested, it wasn't clear whether he was that implied vegetarianism, but all bent on how you translated it. And I was able to talk to an expert in the area who said, actually, no, it doesn't. It probably is a condemnation of empty rituals without actually being a condemnation of all meat eating, the way that people sometimes condemn factory farming without condemning meat eating in principle. So it is. There are so many. There are so many hiccups in translation, and I'm just. And in some cases, I haven't been able to use something because it doesn't exist in translation. There's only a précis of it.
Sure. Is there like one place in the world that's been more vegetarian friendly over history?
Well, obviously, India is the obvious answer, but within India, that's shifted. The there seems to have been a emergence of vegetarianism as an idea in the late first millennium BCE. But specifically, the idea is ahimsa. And people have written contested papers on where exactly ahimsa came from, and whether it was a development of, and which strands of Iron Age Indian religious thought it came from. For a lot of these, I'm digging up research that was done in the, that there was a burst of research in the 1950s and then another burst in the 1970s. And I'm very lucky one of them was translated from German.
Okay, Ian, let's just take a moment here because you're breaking up and I want to be able to hear everything. Oh, there you are. I didn't hear really anything you just said. It was kind of garbled. But what I want to know, can we talk a little bit about the vegan option? Because right now you're almost finishing it up. There seem to be 14 episodes right now. And how did you choose the episodes, what to talk about, and what are some of the things we can hear? I haven't delved into this yet, but looks like some very interesting material.
Well, the vegan option as the
Okay, unfortunately, you're still breaking up, Ian. So, Ian?
Oh, dear.
We're breaking up. So let's just take a minute or two break, and let's see if we can get the internet to kind of line up and hear you clearly, okay? We're going to take a quick break. It's amazing that we're able to communicate this way from so far away and at the same time have our listeners here listen in from everywhere. But it's not always perfect, and I hope we can hear a little bit more about you. So I was asking you about the vegan option and your 15 episodes that we can listen to at theveganoption.org.
So there's a whole host of episodes covering different topics that So I did a show about lab meat. I did a show about cat making material background. I did about spiritual animals. So all so I did a bunch of things about topics and to really dive into charity history in this vicious world. And that's what the 15 episodes are.
Okay, Ian, you know what? We're going to have to pick this up because we really can't hear you right now. And I think it's really unfortunate because you really do have a lot of interesting information to hear, but perhaps we can reconnect shortly. But right now it's not working out. What a date.
I will.
Yeah. So if you can work something out with the studio where we can hear you better, we'll bring you back on. So it's been quite a day here, and it's all about food, hasn't it? Maybe the meat-eating gods are working to keep us from sharing such important information. But the good thing is, if you want to hear more about Ian MacDonald and vegetarian history, the veganoption.com. Now, 14 episodes. Like I said before, I haven't listened to any of them, but they look really fascinating. And, you know, we don't hear enough about vegetarian history, and we can learn so much from what has come before us. It's fascinating. It's inspiring. I mean, to learn about vegetarianism that took place like in the Middle Ages, for example. I mean, who knew, right? And hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, it's just incredible. And we have a lot more in common with our ancestors than we know. And that's because I think there's something inherent in humans. We can go in many different directions, and some of it is in our DNA, and some of it is how we are brought up. If we're brought up with violence, if we're brought up not in the most nurturing, secure environment, we're going to respond to that in a negative way very often. But I do believe that we have this inherent compassion and kindness in us. And when we are surrounded by love and treated with love, we want to give that love back to everyone. And that includes not just humans, but non-humans. And when you get it, pow, you see everything. You see the way the world can work and work well. And it doesn't always happen, but I like to use food as the crack in the door when we discover that we don't need animals to survive. Then we open the door to seeing that we don't need to exploit anything to live well and survive. And then we can bring a lot of beauty to the planet. And, you know, I would really like to know how other people in our history have understood this concept and how they have manifested it. So I find the history fascinating. So let's see. How are we doing with Dr. Ian MacDonald?
Are we? You tell me.
You sound crystal clear.
I just put up the phone and called back again.
Excellent. Okay, well, sometimes just logging off and logging on is what'll do it. Okay, let's get back to the veganoption.org and your 15 episodes.
After I'd done a lot, I was considering maybe a 2 or 3-parter on the history of vegetarianism, and then I realized when I began to research it, it was far bigger and more interesting than I had considered. So it really needed to be an ambitious series. So I put together a Kickstarter so that I knew that my expenses were going to be funded. I took a sabbatical from paid employment so that I had the time to do it. And tackled this this astounding story, talking to the experts, going to places in India, because India is so important to this story. I think you asked where's really important. The answer has to be India. If I was to pick one point on Earth, it would be the Ganges Plain in what's now the state of Bihar in India, in North India. The state whose very name, Bihar, is based on the Buddhist word for a monastery, where in the Iron Age there was this community of wandering holy men and women begging for alms and exchanging ideas like reincarnation and non-violence. And from there, in the form of Jainism and Buddhism, the idea spread throughout India. It was, at the same time, maybe because of inspiration, people started talking about vegetarianism in ancient Greece. But really, so much of the inspiration for vegetarianism, including modern European vegetarianism, comes from India. And can be traced back to as far as we've got records of any kind, to those wandering philosophers in the Iron Age Ganges Plain.
And what's the plan once these 15 episodes are completed? They'll be accessible at theveganoption.org for us to listen to at any time?
Absolutely. Hopefully it'll be a resource that'll be valuable to vegetarians for many years to come. People will just be able to know where we come from, what our story is, and learn it while they're, well, doing the commute or doing the chores.
Okay, so what have you learned from this experience that you can bring with you into the future?
I think the sense of continuity, the sense that if somebody says, but plants though, I know, I can tell them it's not new, because somebody was saying that in the vegetarians had to deal with that in the Roman Empire. There's a certain perspective on disagreements within, but between activists, to see how many of these have happened before. And simply the fact that people act as if vegetarianism was invented in the 1960s, when, let alone veganism, when actually not only was organized vegetarianism a product of the Victorian age, but there have been vegetarians for 2,500 years at least, and probably longer.
Do you have, of all the stories you've learned, is there a favorite or one that surprised you the most?
I think the orgiastic vegetarian cult in 1790s upstate Massachusetts is kind of a favorite, just because it's so weird. I think I'm honestly very surprised by how much comes, not so much from India generally, but from this area that's so small you could walk across it in a day, this really specific region of northern India that gave birth to Jainism and Buddhism. And also the extent to which people make the same comments over time, whether it's you're not a vegetarian if you have mock meat, or which turned up in China, or expecting that people should be ascetic. But also, I think how big the fact that there was a religion with a vegan priesthood that lasted for 1,000 years.
Wow. That is something.
There was a proper world religion. Priesthood is not exactly the right word. And how helpful academics are happy to be if you just want to call them and ask them questions.
Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, we just have really a couple of minutes left, and I want to know about you. How did you become a vegan?
I was growing up asking myself the usual questions about the meaning of life and all that. And into the mix, I read Gandhi's autobiography, his story of my experience with truth, and his arguments for vegetarianism seemed kind of compelling. And I kind of thought, well, I was going back into student halls and they had a form to fill in. Do we feed you vegetarian food or meat? And I like, well, I'm not that bothered. And it's kind of, and if animals have souls, because I was raised a Roman Catholic and I thought in that way, it's probably quite important. It's probably then it's life or death to them, and it's not that much to me, so I'll go vegetarian. And I was vegetarian in a very non-committed kind of way, and that slowly developed into veganism. My parents kind of teased me, my mother and her mother mainly, that I wasn't really being consistent because of what happens to dairy cows and cocks, and so. If I was going to be consistent, I should be vegan. Mm. But of course, that was kind of a dare because they didn't know any vegans. Nobody knew any vegans.
Yeah, that's like, funny.
Nobody was going to do that.
Yeah, that's funny the way they call you on things, and it makes you reflect and it makes you even better. But we just have a few seconds left. So Dr. Ian McDonald, thank you for joining me. It's All About Food. I think we all need to visit theveganoption.org and learn more. Because we weren't able to get it all today, but we can get it all at theveganoption.org. Thank you for your work. This is really fascinating. I really appreciate you finding me and me finding you.
Pleasure to be on the show.
Yes, thank you. That was Dr. Ian McDonald, and I'm going to say his website one last time, theveganoption.org. I also want to remind you, go to responsibleeatingandliving.com, and you can find all those events I was telling you about. There's the Healthy Eating Power Hour. That's tonight. And I hope you register for that. And there are the other events that are starting on June 1st. Okay. Thank you for listening. I'm Karen Hartglass. This has been It's All About Food, and have a delicious week.